An elderly couple arrived at their favorite restaurant. And my wife and I find ourselves eating out a lot more these days. And they were told that they would have to wait 45 minutes to be seated. The couple responded by saying, "My wife and I are both over 90 years old," they said, "and we may not have 45 minutes." Believe it or not, they were seated immediately. As I am now 81 years of age, and having lived a lot of life as pastor of churches and all the rest, worked for GE for 26 years, thank God, because I at least get a pension from them. But I sometimes think and lie awake in the early hours of the morning thinking about all of the things and people I have encountered and talked to and that my wife and I have seen. I want to say once again how much I appreciate the opportunity to be here this morning. Actually, at 81, I appreciate the opportunity to be anywhere. But I need the opportunity to say very thank you, a sincere thank you, to this congregation. The first time I came to this church was the Sunday following 9/11. And I was so impressed with the way Joel handled that during the service. He dealt with it in a way that was beautiful. And my wife and I have been attendees here on and off ever since. Some of you know me as kind of a kingpin or some kind of leader of the men's forum, which meets from October through June here at the church. I relish and enjoy that opportunity to share with you all kinds of subjects, from politics to non-politics. But most of all, I appreciate who you people have been. And I know my wife does too. In particular, I want to bring up one point that really has struck us. During the course of our attendance here, we have become acquainted with a number of gay people. Some of them have been interns in this church. I remember Michelle and her partner, and Michelle became Michael, a transgender. I remember Barbara Rice, who has since moved to the eastern part of this state and ministering to a church out there and living with a partner. And as we came to know those people as real people, early on in my church service, earlier on at First Methodist Church, I was running a Dialogue with the World program, and I had the lady from PFLAG come down and talk to us about the whole business of lesbianism and you know, gay marriage and everything. And she did a wonderful job. And she brought with her and brought to our attention a gentleman by the name of Merle King, who was married to the vice president of Revlon Corporation, who was also gay. And we enjoyed his company and their company immensely. Why is that so important to us? Well, because we now have a grandson, the son, or I would say the daughter originally, of our daughter up in Maine, who is transgender. And we are dealing with that in a very creative and open way that I'm not sure we would have been able to do without your help. So I thank you for that. But what I want to talk to you about this morning is two books, which gave me the title for my sermon. Surprisingly enough, one of them was by Katie Turr, who's a journalist on MSNBC, who my wife and I absolutely love. And the title of her book was After 540 Days Traveling Around Following Donald Trump and His Campaigns. She put together this book describing her experiences, some of them absolutely horrible, at some of the rallies where she was forced to go and sit in a pen to protect her from the crowds. It is an incredible book, extremely well worth reading, and I recommend that to you. I'm always carrying books around. But the other book that I recommend to you is of equal importance. Surprisingly enough, that book was called Unbelievable. John Shelby Spong, a retired Episcopal bishop, has put together just recently a book called Unbelievable. And he talks about the problems the Christian church is facing and the reason for the fall away of so many young people in our churches today, because they cannot find something that they can really believe in the way our present theology is structured. I want you to think about that for a moment. It is a real problem. We do all kinds of restructuring, and you as a congregation have done some wonderful things here, serving meals and providing food for the hungry and items for people who desperately need them. You are to be praised for that. It shows your care for our community in a way that it needs to be done so desperately, although I often wonder, I'll wake up in the middle of the night wondering how much longer you can keep doing that in the light of the overwhelming task that is out there. But still, we do not have really good representation from the younger generation. And why? John Spong refers to them as the Christian alumni because they were raised as Christians, but they don't see any place where they can connect with what we claim we believe here. And I'm trying to deal with that a little this morning, so I hope you'll bear with me a little. In addition to thanks, I want to thank my good wife for having stuck with me all these years. We are celebrating, coming up this next year, on our 60th wedding anniversary. And she has been through it all as a pastor's wife for 7 years down in New Jersey, which made us both kind of bolt out of the full-time ministry and my taking a job up here. But even while I was here, I was running around to small churches everywhere and trying to keep them going, although most of them have since died and are gone now from the face of this Berkshire County. But I am very grateful to her for her patience and for the love she has showed both me and our kids. In our attempts to capture the meaning of the term God, we often find ourselves trying to resurrect the language of the past. In a sense, we find ourselves hiding in the bottom of a cave somewhere, like Elijah, and awaiting some dramatic experience from God that's going to suddenly come along and enlighten our minds. Elijah thought that God would speak to him in the wind and the earthquake and the fire, but it didn't happen. God was most real to him in the silence. You know, we as a society are losing that in our world. With our cell phones in our hands and our loudspeakers and our TVs on, and all five of them on at the same time in the house sometimes. And yet, in the silence that followed for Elijah, the energy and sense of direction for his life came from within himself as he moved to the mouth of the cave and was empowered to be all that he could be. I want you to keep those last words in mind a bit this morning. I want to take us back on a little journey because I have a favorite movie of all time that I cling to often. It was The Cider House Rules, that some of you may remember from back in the 90s, in which a Homer Wells will spend the fall season living in the old cider house with migrant workers and picking apples, that these migrant workers had been doing the same job for years. Now, these workers who cannot read discover that Homer can, and they ask him to read out loud the rules that are posted on the cider house walls. In a nutshell, they are as follows. No smoking in bed. And the migrant said, but that's a no-brainer. Don't operate the apple press if you are drunk. Well, that's a no-brainer. Don't eat your lunch on the roof. Do not go up to the roof to sleep. And no going up to the roof at night. And one of the migrants pipes up. He says, why didn't they just say, keep off the roof? Would have been so much simpler. And as the story evolves, we discover just how irrelevant those rules are. As new issues evolve, which have no rules for guidance. Homer eventually takes the rules down from the wall and he tosses them into the fire saying, these rules were obviously written by someone who never lived here. You know, those Ten Commandments were never really meant to be for all eternity. The old joke goes that when Moses was coming down from the mountain, the crowds were really thrilled because they had read all of the 200 rules and regulations in the book of Leviticus, and they knew all these horrible laws that were in place. And they said, Moses, what have you done to simplify these laws? And he says, I have good news and I have bad news. The good news is that God whittled them down to 10. The bad news is that adultery is still in there. Even the book of Exodus and Deuteronomy have three different versions of the Ten Commandments. The one that I often refer to, which I think I did in my worshipful thoughts that I put together for this congregation, is the last one, the tenth one in the second version, which is recreated because Moses destroys the first two tablets. And the last one of those commandments simply says, you shall not boil your kid in its mother's milk. Now, we raised three daughters and we never were inclined to do that. Leviticus 20:13 states that if a man has sex with another man, both should be put to death. It's an abomination. I doubt if too many even today would believe that along with most of the restrictions outlined in that book, unfortunately, some still do. A community church in Maine, accepting our grandson as part of their youth group, they were very accepting, and he felt so accepted that he was absolutely thrilled by him being able to do that, until they found out that he was receiving hormone treatments and was transgender, at which time the church body suggested that he never come back. The church would accept him as gay, but for some reason not as transgender. Does that make any sense? Our reading from Ephesians suggests those rules that are even more relevant today than most of the Ten Commandments. In brief summary, speak the truth, be angry, but don't sin about it. Let us speak of what builds other people up and put away all bitterness and wrath and anger and slander and all malice and be kind to one another, forgiving one another as Christ showed us. We might call it empathy. We might call it consideration. We might call it all kinds of things, but it involves our expressing our love and openness to all kinds of people. I don't think that I could possibly overstate the problems that the Christian church is facing at this time in its history. In my own experience, as I mentioned earlier, in moving to Pittsfield in 1967 to work for GE as a writer, and as a seminary graduate, having served churches in New Jersey, I have seen many changes. I originally made myself available to local struggling churches in Berkshire County to conduct their Sunday worship, as well as working for GE. And I watched as at least six of those churches no longer exist. Now, that doesn't say much for my preaching, but that's a whole other subject. I also have noticed that our Roman Catholic friends have closed six churches in this town. One of them, St. Teresa's, which is just down the street a ways here, George Wilson, a personal friend of mine for a number of years who recently died, was absolutely horrified because financially they had significant money to go on for years. But why did they close? Because they couldn't find a priest to fill the church. While many of our churches are doing incredible jobs of serving their community and are experimenting with different forms of worship, and some create elaborate jazz services and entertainment experiences and all the rest, but the fundamental problem still exists, and I don't hear it being talked about. It is wrestling with an understanding of the nature of God and the real meaning of the life of Jesus. It is being avoided by all of the so many of the churches. We've all seen the rise of religious fundamentalism and also a large increase in the number of people who have become members of what Spong refers to as the Christian alumni. I've seen Christianity get a bad reputation from many of the vocal conservative fundamentalist groups who are guided by misunderstood pasts and often convey a bigoted reason for their existence based on some obscure rule set down in the Bible, written, as Homer Wells might well have said, by a person who never lived here. And the problem that I often encounter is that this is virtually a progressive church, and I'm grateful for that. But I have friends who have asked me, they watch TV and they see these broadcasters on television from these fundamentalist groups, and they will say to me, is that really what you believe? Is it really? Is it really what all Christians believe? Because if it is, I don't want any part of it. I don't want any part of it. See, our mainstream churches, I think, need a visible theological revolution. In my years in seminary, I explored many of the great theologians of the day. Paul Tillich, Emil Brunner, even Karl Barth. I remember reading all 700 pages of his book on church dogmatics. It drove me crazy, but I got through it. This three-tiered universe that we often fall trap into. You know, God in the heavens, we're on earth, and hell is down below somewhere. It does not exist, my friends, and no longer sells. We've got people talking about space military, we've got people talking about traveling to Mars in 6 months. I don't think, I really hope we can learn how to live on this planet, but anyway, that's another problem. And then we do not really need to be rescued from the sins of Adam and Eve by a God who would subject his only son to a cross to die because we are sinful. I have people look me in the eye and say, that doesn't make sense, does it? We are not fallen creatures in continual need of God's mercy. But we've learned through evolution that we are evolving creatures in various stages of that evolution. In a day where people seeking asylum are having their children taken away from them, when the rich only get richer while so many are struggling to keep a roof over their heads, where we show compassion for fetuses while virtually no compassion for the mother trying to raise a child as a single mother, While I see threats to Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid funding, or health care and Affordable Care Act, we take it away, right? People don't need health care. What is wrong with us? And I see attempts to return to a white nationalism. That offends me more than anything else, I think. We are all human beings. Some of my best friends are African American people who came here generations ago. The world desperately needs voices. Voices of compassion and love, and increasingly the church needs to become that voice in both word and deed. I want to close this morning with a relatively short story, because our oldest daughter, Betty, decided back in the 90s to become a bone marrow donor. And I asked her just this day last week, I said, "Betty, whatever possessed you to do that?" And she said, "You know, the best thing I can say is that a small voice inside me said, I must do this." And a match was found, and unbeknownst to Betty, at the time, he was a high-powered lawyer named Larry, out in the Midwest, who had just been diagnosed with leukemia and given 3 months to live. He had been obsessed with making money, and by all accounts, very, very self-centered, to the degree that his first wife divorced him. She couldn't stand him anymore. He received the transplant, and he transformed his life from being so self-centered to an incredibly caring person. Through my daughter's simple act. His wife at the time of the diagnosis had divorced him, but after the transplant, he met a new partner, and they were married in Sedona, Arizona, to which my daughter, her husband, and her 3 children were invited for an entire week, all expenses paid. He was so thrilled, finally, to learn the identity of my daughter. And he went on to live for 17 years. As a happily married man who died of a heart attack, believe it or not. The conclusion of this story reflects the unending gratitude of his second wife. Unbelievable. And it shows how when you plant the seeds out there, how they can come home. Betty recently held a shower for her expectant daughter, Christine, at her home, and a number of gifts were provided. But several days later, Christine looked out the front window of her home, and there was a big truck out there. And they delivered 37 large cartons to provide for Christine all of the things she would ever possibly need to set up a nursery. They were from Larry's wife. Betty never dreamed or expected that her simple act would ever lead to what she received back. And I could tell you other stories like this. In our own lives, we've experienced this. And why is it so hard for some people to understand that life is about giving? It is about giving to others. And I am absolutely convinced that this image we call God does not live somewhere in some distant place where we need to call him down to change the world as we see it out here. But that this God lives in each and every one of us. And he speaks to us in those moments of silence. I like Deepak Chopra's idea, although it comes from the Far East, really, in terms of an understanding of God, but I love it. He says, God is an information and energy field. And John Shelby Spong picks up on that. Paul Tillich referred to God as the ground of our being, the very ground of our being. And that this God lives in all living things. I want you to think about this for a moment. Plants. My wife is a great gardener, far better than I am. She has beautiful flowers growing in the yard. And as I watch those things burst forth from the earth and come to bud and flower, it's amazing every springtime. Because they are being called by something from within that plant to be all that it can be. I've seen it in small infant animals when they're born. They start out kind of raucous and out of control, and slowly they begin to get their life in sync with the rest of the world to some degree. And I have seen it at work in people, my friends. I have seen it. That this God that lives within us wants each and every one of us to be all that we can possibly be for good and compassion and understanding in this world. That is the task that we are called to. And if we will but listen to that still small voice that Elijah heard in the silence. You know, we each have a job to do when we leave here this morning. To become all that we can be. Continue to show to other people what God's love really means to us. And the compassion, and reach out to others to help others become all that they can be. Jesus showed us the way. Now we as Christians must learn to follow it. Amen.